is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, what Ohio reveals about post-recession America. But first, you might be familiar with Over the Rhine's above-ground history, but what about what's below the surface of this historic Cincinnati neighborhood? The Over the Rhine Museum is presenting Under the Rhine, Tales of Beer, Bones, and Bathrooms. It's the latest installment in the lecture series, Three Acts in Over the Rhine. Here to discuss what lies under the Rhine are Over the Rhine Museum Board Chair Ann Delano Steinert, Over the Rhine Foundation President Kevin Pape, and Over the Rhine Brewery District Executive Director Steve Hampton. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ann, Kevin, and Steve, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Happy to be here.
What a great title for a lecture.
That sums it up.
It's very intriguing. But before we discuss what lies under Over the Rhine, which is hard to say real fast a lot of times, let's talk about each of your organizations, because each of you represents an organization that preserves and celebrates the history and the heritage of Over the Rhine. So, Anne, tell us about the Over the Rhine Museum.
So the Over the Rhine Museum is a relatively new cultural institution in Over the Rhine. We've been around about 3 years, and we're our mission is to collect, preserve, and celebrate all the stories that Over the Rhine has to tell. Our ultimate goal is to do that in a physical museum space. So we're looking to open a museum by 2020, which would be residential units, individual apartments, interpreted to different periods in the neighborhood's history that would allow us to show people how Over the Rhine had changed from, you know, an apartment that might be interpreted to 1870 up to one that might be interpreted to 1980, to see all the different kinds of stories and kinds of people who have called this neighborhood their home.
And that project's based on the New York Apartment Museum, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, the New York Tenement Museum.
Yeah, yep. The New York Tenement Museum. Plenty of stories from Over the Rhine, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, as we've been looking for a building, people have said, how do you know that you're going to find a building that's going to have good stories to tell? And my response is that no matter what building we get, it will be full of great stories to tell.
Now, Kevin, what about the Over the Rhine Foundation?
Well, Mark, the Over the Rhine Foundation was established in 1992. And the mission of the foundation was primarily based on preservation at a time when there were threats to the historic fabric of the community. And things have evolved. The threat is no longer one of preserving the built environment. There are challenges now to how do we fill in the empty spaces, for example? How do we build community? How do we engage people who are interested in having a stake in the community? How do we create a sustainable community? So we are working on those challenges with several initiatives, one of which is writing guidelines for smart infill development. Another is creating support for owner-occupied development, thinking that people who come and invest in the neighborhood, put down roots, become good citizens, engage with the community at large. And then the third piece is what we call green historic, recognizing that the most green building is the one that already exists, but there are certain aspects that are inherent to this historic community, its walkability, the way that the buildings were designed for energy efficiency, and layering on top of that things like solar installations, energy efficiency and new development. And so Over the Rhine is emerging as one of the sort of key places in the entire country that is demonstrating how you restore historic buildings and at the same time achieve LEED certification.
So Steve, tell us about the Over the Rhine Brewery District.
We love beer. No, but we love Cincinnati's brewing heritage. We were one of the biggest brewing centers in the country before Prohibition. We have dozens of historic breweries. And the great thing about the brewing history in Cincinnati is it's really the story of Cincinnati and America. It touched every aspect of the city's history. And so we do a lot of things. We started historic tours of the breweries back in 2006. We're doing a lot of other neighborhood things. And our signature project is the Brewing Heritage Trail. It's a permanent celebration celebration of this brewing heritage to bring more people to the neighborhood as an economic development opportunity, heritage tourism, and to celebrate all that. And so it's this amazing neighborhood, we need to continue to show it off to the world.
So the three of you are doing this lecture tomorrow about what lies under Over the Rhine. So tell me, what is under Over the Rhine? I'm really curious.
Well, the lecture is part of the museum's lecture series, Three Acts and Over the Rhine. And the idea of this series, this is our ninth one, they're quarterly. And the idea is to bring together three different short talks that kind of merge in some way. So one of our board members had this great idea to do Under the Rhine and pull together these three talks. So one is going to be about brewery tunnels and lagering cellars. One's going to be about the former graveyard under Washington Park. And then I'm going to be talking about privies, yard toilets, and the sewer system in Over the Rhine.
Privies and the sewer system. Okay. You got an interesting topic there, Anne. Beer tunnels, Steve.
Mm-hmm. So what drove all those cellars and tunnels was lager beer. So when the Germans brought over lager beer in the 1840s, that's when the brewing industry exploded in terms of its growth. But what you needed to make lager beer was a cold temperature and consistently cold temperature. And you had to get that before mechanical refrigeration by digging deep underground. And so throughout the neighborhood and other parts of the city as well, there are cellars, stone-lined cellars that are 30, 40, even 50 feet deep where they would make and store all this lager beer. Again, we were one of the biggest producers of beer by capita. We were the biggest consumer of beer, so we needed lots of space. On top of that, because we're in a dense urban neighborhood, you needed tunnels to connect these different buildings. And there were some other things down the line with federal tax laws and bottling and that stuff that drove additional tunnels even into the 1880s, 1890s, and turn of the century. And so these spaces are literally hidden from view. We knew where some of them were. We've actually been rediscovering a lot of them over the years. Some of them are underneath buildings that have been torn down. It's a parking lot, but there's still cellars 40 feet underneath that. Some of them we've actually dug out and reconnected tunnels back together with volunteers. And so there's just so much of this history that's literally underneath your feet that when you walk down the street or look at a building, you only see a bit of it. It's kind of like an iceberg. You only see that bit on top, not seeing this huge underground building.
Are these all over the Rhine, Steve? Or there are certain parts of the neighborhood where you find these?
Over the Rhine, the biggest concentration is kind of north of Liberty Street along McMicken, but there are some along Central Parkway, both along the west side and the south side. Historically, breweries were kind of there's some on the riverfront. You had a few more kind of up the river valley, but most of them are in Over the Rhine. That's why we call it the Brewery District, because it's this huge concentration of these breweries, both straight underground and actually into the hillside.
How structurally solid are these tunnels? What kind of construction are we talking about here?
Very, very solid. Those Germans knew how to build. And this was before structural steel was actually the best time to build it. So everything is built out of granite and limestone. These things have stood for 150 years and will stand for another 150 more. So
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. Now, I take it since Ann did bathrooms and sewers, you did bones, Steve? Kevin? Is that right?
I am the bones guy.
You're the bones guy?
Yep.
Okay, tell us the story behind the bones.
Well, the story is it's really one of how the Over the Rhine landscape has evolved over time. And the fact that we as a community have always had to have a place to bury the dead. Cemeteries were established sort of on the outskirts of the building area. And what we know today as Washington Park was established as a cemetery in 1810. And in fact, there were actually two cemeteries there. One section was owned by Christ Church Cathedral, still down on 4th Street, Episcopal Cemetery, and another section was Presbyterian. Across the street, across Elm Street, where Music Hall stands today, was yet another cemetery, a pauper cemetery. And so the cemeteries persisted over time until about 1850, between 1850 and 1860, the city began to grow, and it was no longer feasible to operate as a cemetery. So the thinking was, let's use this as public space. How do we do that? And so a process was developed to disinter the remains and bury them elsewhere. Spring Grove Cemetery was established in 1843. Many of the remains were transferred there, some into the cemeteries in Northside and so forth. Many were not. And so when 3CDC took on the task of revitalizing Washington Park, they recognized its former land use and decided that it was appropriate to do some archaeological investigations and to uncover the remains that were still there.
That's interesting. You used the term archaeology. That does apply in this case. That's what we're talking about.
Absolutely, yes.
Now, Anne, you are handling bathrooms and sewers.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us about that.
Yeah, so my part of the talk is talking about the privy vaults that remain under the ground in Over the Rhine. So,
okay, so privy is another word for a bathroom, right?
Right,
okay.
Well, yeah, and some people would say earthen toilet, you know, just basically a hole in the ground where you're – has a little nice building over the top of it with the seat, an outhouse where you would go to the bathroom. So that was where people went to the bathroom from the earliest beginnings all the way up until they were able to get a sewer connection. And the earliest availability of sewer connections in Cincinnati was 1871. And then there was a law in 1877 that said, if you do have access to a sewer connection, you are required to hook up. But the thing is that most of Over the Rhine was actually already built by that point. Most of the built environment in Over the Rhine predates those 1870 dates. So Over the Rhine would have had at least one privy per building throughout the entire neighborhood. And so what drew my attention to this topic is that we really don't see that anymore. You know, it's this sort of forgotten or lost piece of the built environment, the above ground part. But also, when you tore down the little house, the privy below got filled in and left behind. So there are still these, they're stone or brick lined vaults, anywhere from 10 to 20 feet in depth. And when they were closed, also, they were generally filled in with debris so that they wouldn't be a hazard. So they're, Bob Genheimer at Museum Center has described it to me as the best source of 19th century material culture we have available to us in Cincinnati. And yet most of it is still buried beneath the grounds of Over the Rhine.
So it comes back to archaeology. And as an archaeologist,
how much history do you get from old privies and old bathrooms?
Tremendous. And Bob's right. Not only is it a wealth of material culture, but it's a time capsule, and it's divided into layers stratigraphically. The oldest is at the bottom, the newest is at the top, and you excavate it, and you can tell pretty compelling stories about who lived there, what they were doing, and some very interesting things come out about people's lives that are not necessarily recorded in the histories.
Right. There's definitely some literature about the fact that people used privies to conceal things that they didn't want anyone else to know about. It was really the only kind of private space you had living in a tenement full of, you know, 20, 30 other people. So sometimes privy excavations actually reveal kind of startling things. Lots of alcohol bottles where the alcoholic in the neighborhood was going out to drink himself
Prohibition.
Away. Right. Yeah. But then I'm also going to talk about the transition to outdoor flush toilets and what happened when sewerage became available to Over the Rhine.
We will continue our conversation about Under the Rhine, and you can join us 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and here to discuss what lies under the Rhine are Over the Rhine Museum Board Chair Anne Delano Steinert, Over the Rhine Foundation President Kevin Pape, and Over the Rhine Brewery District Executive Director Steve Hampton. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Steve, the tunnels, how long are most of these?
Most of the tunnels are literally just across the street. They're connecting different parts of the breweries. And there were a couple reasons for that. One is just as the neighborhood was so dense and they grew, they couldn't always grow literally next door to them. But there were also tax laws that you had to separate your bottling operations from your brew works. And so up until 1890, you literally had to cart your beer across the street. 1890, they changed the tax laws, allowed you to have a tunnel or a pipeline connecting these two parts of your brewery. And so you started to see a lot of them even that late into the neighborhood. So they were dug connecting buildings well after they were built. But they had to dig them deep enough to get underneath the water lines and the sewer lines that were already in the street. So again, most of these are 30 or 40 feet underground.
Yeah, and you could stand inside these? How tall? How wide were these?
They're all a little different. All of them you could walk through. Some of them were just basically a tunnel for that they would attach pipelines to. But some of them, like in Kaufman, were big enough you could almost take a cart through them with barrels of beer. And so each one of them is kind of unique, which is really exciting when you get a chance to see them all together.
Now, are they interconnected or are these just separate tunnels?
So they're interconnected only within the individual brewery complexes. Now, we've heard stories over the years where there were maybe more connections over time. Obviously, over Prohibition, they were probably used for some nefarious purposes. We don't have great records since everything was a little legal at the time, but we know a lot of these breweries illegally brewed real beer during Prohibition. So we're pretty sure some of them were used in some ways. But they're still a really unique connection. And this consists of both the tunnels, the vaults underneath the sidewalks, the actual multiple levels of cellars. So these cellars underneath the buildings are not just one massive. They're actually two or three levels of these stone cellars stacked on top of each other.
And I guess today people can take tours of the tunnels. Is that right, Anne?
Mm-hmm. Yep. The brewery district actually runs really great tunnel and cellar tours. Yeah.
Yeah. Are the tunnels lit or do you need a flashlight to go through these?
No, we do provide lights. So we try to make it a little easy for you. But you actually have to go down some, OSHA and building codes didn't really exist at the time. So we have to get a little creative sometimes getting down into these spaces.
So is there an expectation that more tunnels might be found or have they pretty
there
much all
are
been covered?
A handful of locations that we have a pretty good idea. A great example is when they were renovating our neighborhood a school. There was a parking lot across the street, a small little one-story building that was built in the 1940s. And we knew it was the site of an old brewery, but it had been torn down after Prohibition. And when they started digging for the water, stormwater retention, they actually broke into cellars that had been sealed up underneath this parking lot in this other building for 100 years. And so we're getting a better idea of where those were, but there's still a couple that were out there that we think we can discover. So, mm-hmm.
And Kevin, as far as burial sites, have they pretty much all been uncovered and over the Rhine at this point, or might there be more that we don't know about?
There are probably a few small cemeteries that are scattered throughout, but the cemetery at Washington Park is known, and same with the Popper Cemetery beneath Music Hall. Now the section that was the Presbyterian Cemetery is still there beneath the park.
And that's the southern portion of the park.
That's the southern portion, yeah.
So what do you find when you go and do archaeology? What's fascinating that you come up with?
Well, what's fascinating is the way that the variety of stories you can learn. So one of the things that you see are how changes occur over time and sort of the treatment of death of the deceased. And in the earliest burials, they are simply wrapped in a shroud or a winding sheet. And you find very little material other than pins that held the sheets together. As time goes on, the beautification of death, the romanticism of treatment of the dead begins to influence those outcomes, and people are buried in clothing, some of their finest clothes, so on. There are poignant stories to be learned of victims of the cholera epidemics. You can see that in terms of multiple burials within a single shaft or even within single coffins, and other instances of women who died in childbirth, for example. So you see there are just many, many kinds of stories you don't even think about that you can learn from.
You are really getting a glimpse into the neighborhood's past.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And now you were going to also talk about, you mentioned the history of sewers as mm-hmm. well as what was found under over the Rhine.
Right.
But tell us a little bit more about that. That's interesting too.
Well, so like I said, many buildings in Over the Rhine didn't take the opportunity to hook up to sewers for a long time. I looked at a two-block stretch of Pleasant Street at one point and identified – so the earliest hookup possibility would have been 1871. But by 1912, there were still 13 buildings on this block that hadn't chosen to hook up to the sewers. So there was a lot of resistance, actually. People were worried. People believed that sewer gases caused illness, and would actually make you sick. And so people didn't necessarily want to be connected to the sewers. And more than that, they didn't want that coming into their home. So even when they did connect into the sewer, they often kept their sewer-connected flush toilet out in the backyard. And in fact, it was actually legal in Cincinnati to have a flush toilet in your backyard up until the law was passed in 1962 to outlaw them, and it gave you a 5-year window to comply. So really, up till 1967, you could theoretically have an outdoor toilet. And there was a study done in the 50s. The mayor commissioned a study that showed that in the basin neighborhoods of Cincinnati, so the West End, downtown, and Over the Rhine combined, there were 20,000 outdoor toilets still existing. And we don't know for sure if they were being used or not, but still existing in 1950.
Is it common if somebody's renovating a building in Over the Rhine that they come across a privy?
Mm. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Very often, yeah. And actually, it's the privy, but you also often see all those various stages of connections. So the privy, the adding the sewer, then adding just a water closet on each floor when it was still tenements. Then maybe they combined all the units and put a private bathroom within the unit. So within the buildings and the backyards, you see all these layers of history and all these different steps over the years.
You know, one of the things that's kind of interesting, too, about the evolving technology of bathrooms is there's a whole industry around maintaining privies and the honey dippers and so on.
Right.
Anne, are you going to talk about those?
Yeah,
the honey dippers.
Yeah, well, so they were officially known as night soil men. Honey dippers is kind of a nickname for the people who would go and clean out these earthen privies. So the law required that your privy had to be cleaned when the excrement came within 4 feet of the surface. So it was up to the building owner to pay to have a night soilman come, and they were only allowed to work between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. because what they were going to do is scoop out all the waste material out of your privy, put it in a cart, and cart it through the city streets. There was a sullage boat that waited on the river at a place at the Wood Street Wharf, which was way in the lower West End. And every night, all these night soilmen would bring their loaded carts and dump them onto this boat, which then went out and into the Ohio River and dumped the waste right into the stream of the Ohio River every night for 100 years, probably.
So why is it important to understand the underground history of Over the Rhine?
Well, to me, as Over the Rhine is changing so rapidly today, it's really, you know, invigorated in a lot of ways. And some of the echoes of the past that used to be very evident are getting lost or being silenced in some ways. So to me, it's really important that we acknowledge that we've got this other, besides the built environment and what we can see above the streets, we've got this other amazing, rich resource of Over the Rhine's history waiting beneath the ground that we should be mindful of and thinking about and taking advantage of.
Yeah.
And I would add, too, that the archaeology, particularly of privies, as we recognized before, is very rich and can interpret the past and stories and the people that lived here in ways that our history never will. These are people who are underrepresented in standard historical texts, but the archaeology reveals much of their lives in the community.
And I would love to see incentives for people who renovate buildings in Over the Rhine to actually do some archaeology and find what's in the privy behind the mm-hmm. house before they, you know, start to rip it up and put new construction in there. It would be lovely.
Many communities are doing that now.
Yeah. Well, in New York City, when I lived in New York City, there is Lower Manhattan has a requirement for urban archaeology for new development projects. That would be great.
Pittsburgh does, too.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
So when and where is the lecture?
So the lecture is tomorrow night, Thursday the 29th. It's at St. Francis Serif Church. The doors are going to open at 6 o'clock p.m. and we'll have noshing and hanging out for half an hour. And then at 6:30, we'll start the talks. And I just want to put a plug in. We're really thankful that this the program is funded by Fuel Cincinnati. And also St. Francis Serif has been incredibly generous. We had originally scheduled for a smaller room, and we've had so much excitement about the event that we now had to move it to the actual sanctuary of the church.
Well, Ann, Kevin, and Steve, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
Over the Rhine Museum Board Chair, Ann Delano Steinert, over the Rhine Foundation President, Kevin Pape, and over the Rhine Brewery District Executive Director, Steve Hampton. You can find a link to more information about the three acts and Over the Rhine Lecture Series at wvxu.org.